I want to begin tonight with a story. Usually I say the story for last, but tonight I'm going to start with a story. It's a little deceptive because it's going to be a very, very deep shiur tonight. So I think the story will sort of get us into the mode to open our minds up a little. The story is told of a chassid of the Chayza from Lublin. You've all heard of the Holy Chayza, the Seer of Lublin, Yankov Yitzchak Horowitz, the Seer of Lublin, known as the Seer. The Chayza, everyone knows, had one big eye and was missing the second eye. Sort of like Papai Lahavdil. One very big eye and was missing the second eye, and everyone said that the Chayza with that one eye saw more than everyone else sees with two eyes. The Chayza was able, if he looked at your forehead, he was able to see every thought that you had from the time you were born. Which is why everyone knew who his chassidim were. The chassidim of Lublin would walk around with their hats like this. That was the style in Lublin. That's how you knew it was a Lubliner chassid. And there's a story that one time there was a chassid of the Chayza that came right before Pesach to the Rebbe, to the Chayza, and cried that he had absolutely not one penny with which to make Pesach. To be able to pay for Passover, all the things that are need, the necessities, it's a fortune. He didn't have a penny, he didn't have a way to start. It was a couple days before, he didn't have a penny how to start to make Passover. So the Chayza said to him, "Don't worry, I'll make sure it's taken care of." And the story is that Mamish, 2 days before Passover, 2 days before Pesach, somebody came to the door and knocked on his door and said that your great aunt Francine, I don't know if it was called Francine in Poland, but your great aunt, whatever, Sprinza, passed away from the other side of Russia, and you just got an inheritance of 1,000 rubles, which was a fortune. He was so happy. The Chayza's blessing came true. He took some of the money, took 20 rubles, and he bought a Passover that no one in the whole Lublin had such a Pesach. And he set the table like a wealthy man with a huge table completely set. He was all excited. When he sat down at the first Seder, the first night, Mamish feeling like a king. His wife was dressed up like a queen. Like Tevye says, strutting like a peacock, proper double chin. Everything was beautiful. Everything was all set. And he was sitting there, glorifying in what was in front of him. And they did the Seder slowly. And they enjoyed, using the gold dishes that he bought. And it was he never in his life had such a Seder. And because they were having such a good time, the Seder went till 5 o'clock in the morning. The whole night they sat singing and enjoying themselves, him and the family. When it came time for the second night, and the Israelis among us remember that the rest of the world have two Sedarim, have two Passover Seders. When it came time for the second Seder, by the time it was late afternoon, the whole family was exhausted. This chassid and everyone was so tired, everyone was exhausted. They were up until 5 o'clock in the morning, they didn't get a chance to nap. So they figured it's another hour or two till Mincha, they'll take a rest. So they all went to sleep, and what do you know, when did they wake up? About a half hour before sunrise. It was just angeschlufen, they all fell asleep, and they woke up, it was a half hour before sunrise. And they didn't daven Ma'ariv yet. So they quickly whipped out the Seder and they davened Ma'ariv, and they quickly took out the wine, and the wine was spilling, and the matzahs, and the matzahs at the time they did the four questions, they read the Haggadah, and then the men, and the Mor, and then the Karpas, and before sunrise they had to get to the matzah. And then a minute before sunrise they finally ate the matzah. And they were schwitzing like whatever. And they were so disappointed. This year that they were able to make Pesach, and look at this Seder, when they were very disappointed. The next morning, this chassid walks into shul, crestfallen, trudges into shul, and all of a sudden the Chayza turns around, the Holy Seer of Lublin, and he looks at this chassid and he says, "Oh, Moishala, tell everyone in the shul, hundreds of chassidim there, tell everyone about your Seder. I saw in the heavens that the Seder that you had was one of the most beautiful Passover Seders since the Jews left Egypt." So Moishala thinks and he says, "Oh, you're talking about the first night. You're talking about the first Seder that we had. The first night. Let me..." He said, "No. I want to know about the Seder from last night, or from this morning." So Moshe says, "Rebbe, please don't embarrass me like that. Maybe you didn't see right. You mean that you want me to tell you about the first Seder?" So the Chayza says, "No, Moshe, tell me about the second Seder." So Moshe started crying. He said, "Rebbe, the second Seder? The second Seder was a disaster." So the Rebbe said to him, "No, Moshe, the second Seder was from the sweetest since the Jews left Egypt. Because the second Seder, everything you did was only for God. That's all. Just because you had to, because God said so. Absolutely not the slightest inkling of enjoyment or because you wanted it. It was completely, you didn't even have a chance to have a wrong thought. It was 100% a half hour just because God said so. And that story really touches on a nerve, a raw nerve by many people, and I could probably say being one of them, especially for American people. You know, today, growing up, you know, I'm sure you remember, I know when I could talk for myself, that growing up, the worst words that you could ever hear, the most despicable, annoying words that you could hear from your parents, from your teachers, probably remember, "'cause I said so." Remember those words? "'Cause I said so." It's like, you know, when you sit in a therapist's office and you deal with, you know, the trials and travails of youth, so those moments when, you know, your parents looked at you with that look, and the teachers with their dirty looks, and just said, "Because I said so." Those are the words that American children cannot hear. And I want to tell you something interesting. You know that the past 50 years, there have been a lot of American Jews. It's not even so much the past 20 years. I'm talking about from after World War II. There was a whole generation of American Jews that many, many of them were lost forever to Judaism, to Torah, for the simple reason of the generation gap that was so radical from European Jewry to American Jewry. And that was the idea that the way that the American society brings up children and people generally is completely different than the way things were in Europe. And I'm talking about, I don't have time to get into history, but this has since the Enlightenment, this has been going on for centuries until finally the grand finale, is that when you say to an American kid, you go over to a 10-year-old American kid today, "'cause I said so." So he'll say to you, "Well, who are you?" You have a 10-year-old. "Excuse me, what gives you the right to repress me?" You know, 10-year-old looks at his parents in the eye and says, "This is a democracy, excuse me, I have an inalienable right to freedom. Who gives you the right to infringe upon my rights? I'm being repressed. Remember that line? "Hey, look, help, I'm being repressed. That's a 10-year-old will say that today. And that's why today, I still merit it, I must say, that I merited that old-fashioned education. Baruch Hashem, it didn't hurt me, wasn't too much of a detriment. But I was brought up, my grandparents, Zecharin Levrach, my grandfather, Zecharin Levracha, my grandparents are Holocaust survivors, so I'm officially a third-generation Holocaust survivor, but I grew up in my grandparents' house a lot. And my grandparents are the type of people, my grandmother, she should be old till 120, but especially my grandfather was that type of person that by him, Judaism had nothing to do with explanations. Explanations in Judaism were not related, b'chlal. I grew up at my grandfather's, from the time I remember myself, when I would say, "Zaidi, put on your tzitzis." "But why Zaidi?" "Steit geschrieben." That was his answer. "Steit geschrieben. It's written, it says. Steit geschrieben. It's written, it says. Steit geschrieben." That's all he said to me. The truth is, he didn't know more. He was at the age of 80, he was an orphan. He had to go to work when he was already 8 years old. He never had an opportunity to learn. And he lived his 86 years not understanding anything. And understanding that's how Yiddishkeit is. Steit geschrieben. I said, "Zaidi, what's this whole thing of praying? Steit geschrieben. It says you have to. What do you mean?" And there's a whole generation of American Jews, that first generation in America, that were lost because the immigrants, that generation of the immigrants, didn't have the tools to be able to explain this idea of that there is something just because God said so. You know, the famous idea, Reb Moshe Feinstein, Zichron Levracha, Reb Moshe Feinstein said that a whole generation of Jews were lost because of the words, "Shverze Zayne Yid." Shverze Zayne Yid means it's hard to be a Jew. Now, my grandfather would say that all the time. My grandfather, I remember going back from shul, Rosh Hashanah, going back to shul, we'd come back from shul and have the meal. I'll never forget this, and have the meal, and then we'd go to Tashlich. Walk to Tashlich, my grandfather would start crying, and he would say, "So shver zayin yid, but look how beautiful the Jews, the whole day they're in shul, and we had a labai, now we're going to Tashlich, shver zayin yid," and he would give a krech to shver, "It's hard to be a Jew." And Ramesh said most of American Jewry were turned off, they weren't interested in something that's hard. and everything that American society has to offer. What do you mean, because God said so? I need to understand it. And the truth is that the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, has a letter from 1963. This is 6 years before Woodstock. The Rebbe has a letter in 1963 before Rosh Hashanah where he writes that Rosh Hashanah is a holiday all about accepting a king, the coronation of the king. And the Rebbe writes that seemingly this generation in America, the whole idea of a monarchy, the whole idea of accepting a yoke, the whole idea of giving up on one's freedom is alien to the very fiber of the society of America. The Rebbe writes, but that's the Mila. That's, on the other hand, that's why a Jew that was brought up in America, and I don't just mean America, the continental United States. I mean that today pretty much the whole world has gone after this philosophy, this way, outlook of America of complete freedom, do whatever the hell you want. So the Rebbe says that a person that was brought up with that freedom, with that ability, and yet decides to connect to God, that connection will be the deepest connection. Because there's a mile, there's an advantage to a person that any connection they have, they forge with God, is coming completely from within. After all, God doesn't want an army of robots. God is not looking for an army of robots. God is looking for an army of human beings, rational human beings. And this brings us to tonight's discussion. And I'm just warning you before, parental discretion advised. I apologize if this is not the usual style, but tonight we're going to be discussing very heavy-duty philosophy. And we will tie it into Chassidus, of course, and the opposite, to see how Chassidus illuminates an idea in philosophy. But the age-old question, which is the debate that has been going on through philosophers for many generations, and I'm talking about also Jewish philosophers, Gentile philosophers, la'avdil, is the question is, when we speak about that conflict or that contrast, because God said so, or because I understand that to be right, the way that the philosophers have termed it is what's known as either revelation morality or autonomous morality. Which means, we all understand that a human being, by virtue of being a human being, should be moral, should act ethically. The question is, and this is what philosophers have been discussing, what should be the reason, the impetus for my acting ethically? Why should I be moral? Why should I not kill someone? Why should I not steal? Revelation morality, which is generally the religious way of looking at things, and I don't mean here religious by, you know, orthodox as opposed to whatever, I mean those that believe in God firmly, etc., as being a guiding light in their life. Revelation morality says that the ultimate is to be moral because God said so. Because God said so. The ultimate meaning in life is to do things because God said so. And therefore, even when it comes to being ethical, morality, the ultimate morality is because God said so. That's what a person needs to do. On the other hand, the other school, the other side of the coin of autonomous morality means that's not called being moral. Morality is that you're moral because you do the right thing because you feel that it's the right thing to do. The way that the philosophers have termed these two things is, do we say theological morality or moral theology? Theological morality says, the revelation morality, theological morality is that morality is what God says morality should be. That's what the human being should be looking at. What does God say is the right thing to do? Autonomous morality or moral theology says what you believe to be moral, that should be your theology. And you all understand that each side of the coin has a very big advantage. Each side of the coin you can't seem to be winning arguments. On the one hand, revelation morality says, theological morality says, what possibly could there be as a source for me discomforting myself, inconveniencing myself in life, doing things not because I want to do them, if not for God? The revelation morality says that there any human being that attempts to act ethically because it's the ethical, the right thing to do, is doomed to fail. And everyone knows what's the ultimate example of that the Rebbe brought all the time? Nazi Germany. The German people from whom we're going to quote very soon, well, not the Nazis, but the German people. The German people, if we as Jews can manage to be objective, could say that in Europe, the greatest intellectual accomplishments in the 200 years before World War II was from Germany. There was no place that produced such intellectual phenomena like Germany the 200 years before World War II. After France had a decline, it could be debated. And yet we see what happened in Germany in Auschwitz. So what do you mean morality without God is meaningless? What God says, that is morality. That is morality. One has to have God. That's the ultimate inspiration and the only inspiration that's going to cause a person to be moral. Yet on the other side of the coin, says, I should be a zombie. If I just do God says so, I relinquish all intellectual prowess, I relinquish any meaning to humanity. God says so. I become a zombie. Now, listen carefully. I'm going to repeat this again later, but I want you to hear it now. Everyone knows that in Judaism, there's a concept of mishpatim, of the statute, the ordinances, the laws of ben adam lechavero, between man and man, that are intellectually understood. Mishpatim, right? Not to murder, not to steal. We all know that there are those mitzvot, there are those laws that we understand. That it's, you're not supposed to kill, you're not supposed to murder. But many sources in Judaism say, I shouldn't kill. It's a mishpat. In other words, it's a logical law. Logic dictates me not to kill, right? But many sources in Judaism say, but why shouldn't I kill? Because God said so. There are many sources that says, that's not enough of a good reason. Even though these mitzvahs are logical, respect your parents, don't kill, don't murder. Many sources, including most places in Chassidus, stress this very much, because God said so. And the opposite, like we said before, if you're not murdering because you understand it to be, by the way, those people sitting in back, there are seats over here. You could come, move in. You can move in. There are chairs over here. Bring in chairs. Why should you sit outside? You could hear. As we said before, if the basis is going to be because I understand that murdering is wrong, so then you end up with Nazi Germany. So of course Judaism says there are things that are logical, but that's not the issue. The issue is, do I do them because God said so or because my logic dictates? Now, the ultimate quintessential example that's used to stress this idea, and you all understand, it's important to point out that the question is an even deeper question. Listen, the question is not only why should I be moral and why should I be ethical? Because God said so, or because inherently there's a value to ethics and humanity and intellect. It becomes a deeper question. Why should I be moral? There's a much deeper question, and that is a much more fundamental question. What should be the ultimate guiding light in my life for the way that I act? What should be my recipe book for life? What should be my ultimate instruction manual for life? The will of God, or does my intellect and my humanity also have a word to say? Do I nullify myself completely and become, I do the will of God? And that's the ultimate. And I don't need to tell you, Chassidus, of course, most places says that that's necessary. And that's not becoming a zombie, it's becoming unified with God in the ultimate way. That's true. But the other side of the coin says, the autonomous morality says, do you really think God intends you to throw your intellect out the window? Do you really think that God means, God wants, that connection with Him at the highest level means throwing out humanity? Humanity has no inherent value, no inherent worth. Just become nullified to God? Or is there an inherent value to intellect? The quintessential example that becomes the source for this debate is, of course, this week's Parsha, the Akedah. Akedas Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac. There could be no possible story in the whole Bible that is more intriguing than this week's parasha, Genesis chapter 22, when God tells Avram to do the most immoral act that a person could imagine. Take his innocent son, child, man, whatever you want to call it, and kill him. And Abraham passes the test. heeds the word of God and goes to slay his only son. So let's begin with, we're going to use tonight, based on the Alter Rebbe's directive for the end of chapter 8 of Tanya, his heter. We're going to use tonight two philosophers, two great philosophers, contrast them, and then we'll see how Chassidus explains the idea. So let's begin with, as I said before, one of the greatest minds that lived in the past couple hundred years, and that was a Gentile philosopher called Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant from Prussia, you know that Reb Shlomo Breuer, Zichrono Livracha, the head of German Jewry, had two pictures on his wall. One is of Shamshon of Ful Hirsch, and the other one was of Kant. Anyone that taps into philosophy cannot remain oblivious to Kant. Today, Kant was the greatest mind that the Gentiles had for many, many years. And he essentially calls Abraham, in a book that he wrote, a short work on morality, he calls him, I don't want to say, but essentially he calls him being stupid, obtruse, ridiculous. He takes Abraham to task. Kant was known as having the most rigorous morality that ever was put forth in all the schools of philosophy. I don't want to take up too much time, but Kant's philosophy, morality, was what he named the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative means that morality is so unbending and absolute that if your friend is running away from a murderer that's trying to kill him, and your friend is taking refuge in your house, and the murderer knocks on your door and says, "Is your friend here in the house?" You have to say, "Yes, he is." Because to lie is immoral. That's how extreme he is. Now, again, we're not going to, you know, that could be shot, holes could be shot throughout that. We're not going to get into that. But the idea of Kant is that there is no God other than morality. There is no necessary any other God other than morality. You know, in his epitaph, by the way, on Kant's grave, it's a beautiful quote that he said. Kant says, "There are two things that fill me with ever-increasing awe and wonder. The starry heavens above me and the moral law within me." And Kant looked at the moral law, the humanity's idea of morality, as the ultimate guiding light. Kant writes that by definition, any morality that's not autonomous is not morality. Every morality needs to be self-defined. Because, listen carefully, if there's any source that's telling you to be moral, if you're doing something, the right thing to do, because somebody else is telling you, whether it's God or not, you're not moral. In order for you to be moral, in order for you to be ethical, you have to be doing ethics because you understand it to be true. If it's not self-imposed, if it's not self-contained, if you're not being ethical because your humanity, your mind dictates to be moral, then you're not moral. To the extent that he says, he condemns Abraham and he says that Abraham's response should have been to God, or whatever voice he heard, his response should have been, when God said, "Kill your only son," Abraham should have responded and said, that I know that to kill my son is immoral, that I am certain. To kill is immoral. Therefore, whoever you are is wrong. No matter how majestic a supernatural a voice was coming out of heaven, Kant should have said, "You are wrong. You must be a demon, it can't be God." No matter which magic tricks, no matter how God would have tried to make himself revealed, Abraham should have said, nothing could possibly go against morality. Humanity is the ultimate value. Now, that does not mean that Kant denies God. He does not deny that, whether he does or not. Doesn't mean that he denies the fact that there's such a thing as a transcendent God. But he writes as follows, and I want to quote you. I want to read to you a sentence from Kant. Listen carefully. "The veiled goddess before whom we bend our knees is the moral law within us. To be sure, we hear her voice and clearly understand her commandments. But are in hearing them, we are in doubt as to who is speaking. Whether it is man in the self-sufficient power of his own reason, or another transcendent one whose nature is unknown and who speaks to man through the medium of his reason. Perhaps we would do better to refrain from even inquiring. For such a question is merely speculative, and our duty remains the same, whatever the source from which it issues. Which means, reason, intellect, morality, that is God. Anything else is unnecessary. Whether it's coming from a transcendent source or not, irrelevant. Humanity means logic, ethics, and that's how a person should act. That's Kant. On the complete opposite side of the spectrum, the other extreme, is another philosopher, an extremely great person, known as Soren Kierkegaard. Soren Kierkegaard, in his phenomenal work, Fear and Trembling, since 1843 when it was published, no one could remain untouched. No one could touch the story of the Akedah, of Binding of Isaac, without Kierkegaard's philosophy. It's very interesting. It's already been pointed out by many Jewish philosophers, the Hashgacha Pratis, the divine providence, that at that same time in mid-19th century, when Kierkegaard was founding the school of existentialism, at that same time in the Jewish people, there was a certain school of Hasidus, and that was particularly the Polish school of Hasidism, Remendel Kotzker. And his students, the Kotzker and his students, the students being Reb Tzadok Ishbitzer, Reb Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin, the Sfas Emes, that whole Polish school of Hasidic thought, Hasidus Bechlal, everyone knows, has a very deep mystical tendency, has a very keen feeling of God's immediate presence, God's very deep connection to every human being on an individual basis, a very big stress on individual spirituality. That's especially this Polish school of Chassidus, and that's what Kierkegaard is all about. Kierkegaard writes the exact opposite of what Kant wrote. And that is, that's what the whole book is about, Fear and Trembling. Avraham's path to become the knight of faith, knight with a K. The knight of faith. According to Kierkegaard in his writings, to become a knight of faith means to be in a position of an absolute relationship to God, which means standing in a state of absolute isolation from anyone other than just you and God. And that means that a person has to be able to make a commitment to God without any mediation, without any intermediary of any standards that are accepted and understood by human beings. Any mediation of ethics or religion. The ultimate struggle of the night of faith is to be able to enter a face-to-face relationship with God. What Kierkegaard calls to become the solitary one. Where a person enters a covenant with God that excludes anything, anyone else. And that means, of course, his ultimate example is Avram Avinu. That means going above whatever is considered universal. As long as a person is functioning based on anything that's universal, whether it's ethics, whether it's religion, as long as my deeds are being motivated by things that other people could understand, and other people will cheer for me, and other people will relate to me, you have not yet become the knight of faith. You have not yet come to a state where term that Kierkegaard gives it is the teleological suspension of the ethical. The teleological suspension of the ethical means as follows. Ethics is what humanity understands, universal humanity understands to be the right way to act. Ethics, religion, whatever it is. Teleological means with a specific purpose. The theological suspension of the ethical means the ability to suspend ethics, to suspend what all humanity anticipates from me, expects from me, agrees with me, and say that now I'm going to enter my relationship with God and nobody else could be part of it. Not intellect, not religion, that's faith. And that's why Kierkegaard scoffs, he laughs at those that think that faith is a simple thing. That itself is a Hasidic concept, right? The idea that emuna, faith, is something that's an avodah, that's a service that a person needs to toil one's whole life. He has a whole introduction where Kierkegaard writes that those that base themselves on Descartes, all modern philosophy is traced back to Descartes, what's known as Cartesian doubt. Descartes began modern philosophy because he began by doubting everything. Nothing has credence. And let's begin from the beginning. That's where he came to I think, therefore I am. Nothing has meaning. Doubt every existence of anything. Let's begin from scratch what my mind says. And therefore Kierkegaard writes that most people today will say, oh, I'm now beginning to learn. I'm ready to go beyond faith. So he laughs, Kierkegaard laughs. That's like, you know, faith is something like a childhood disease that you need to get over. That's what people think. Faith is for beginners. Faith is for children. Faith is something that you need to go beyond. When in fact it's the exact opposite, one has to struggle one's whole life with faith. And you'll permit me, I hope, I'm going to read to you a little from Kierkegaard. I thought I couldn't control myself, I had to read this to you because it's an unbelievable paragraph over here. It's just such a beautiful thing that I need to read it to you. He's writing almost an apology to Abraham, to Avram Avinu. He's apologizing if he's not presenting him in all his glory. Venerable Father Abraham, when you journeyed home from the mountain in Moriah, you needed no speech of praise to console you for what was lost. For in fact, you gained everything and kept Isaac. Was it not so? The Lord never again took him from you. You sat happily at table with him in your tent, as you do in the hereafter for all eternity. Venerable Father Abraham, thousands of years have slipped by since those days, but you need no late coming lover to snatch your memory from the power of oblivion. For every mother tongue commemorates you, and still you reward your lover more gloriously than anyone. You make him blessed thereafter in your bosom. You captivate his eye and his heart in the here and now with the marvel of your deed. Venerable Father Abraham, you who foresaw and bore witness to that tremendous passion that scorns the fearful struggle with the raging elements and the forces of creation in order to struggle with God instead. You who first knew that supreme passion, that sacred, pure, and humble expression of the divine madness which even the pagans admired. Forgive him who would speak in your praise if he did not do so correctly. He spoke humbly, seeing it in his heart's desire. He spoke briefly, as is fitting, but he will never forget that you needed 100 years to get that son of your old age against every expectation, that you had to draw the knife before keeping Isaac. He will never forget that in 130 years, you got no further than faith. The ultimate lesson of Abraham is that one can get no further than faith. That is the ultimate. But Kierkegaard is also an extremist. He goes to the extreme and says, one needs to love one's neighbor. You need to be ethical. But he writes that when you do that, you're not entering a relationship with God. You're entering a relationship with your neighbor. I don't deny the fact Kierkegaard says that you have to be ethical, but you should know that's not God. That's a relationship with your neighbor. To have a relationship with the absolute, one needs to be in absolute isolation. To the extent that he writes, in the solitude of the universe, the knight of faith hears no human voice, but walks alone in his dreadful responsibility. And that's the fear and trembling. That's why he calls the book Fear and Trembling. The fear and trembling is that awe that a person has when he realizes that he has to disengage himself from humanity, put himself into a self-imposed exile from all humanity, just him and God. and stand before God as the solitary one, that's the fear and trembling. Completely throw the intellect out the window. Throw universality out the window. More than that, he says it's a defiance of the universal ethic. And that's why Kierkegaard also writes that you can't even define Abraham as a tragic hero. He differentiates between the knight of faith and a tragic hero. He says there have been in history many tragic heroes. A tragic hero is one that's willing to sacrifice, the ultimate sacrifice as an expression of something ethical. Take an example of killing your child. He brings a few examples. Yiftach and his daughter, for example, he brings. Yiftach, who vowed the first thing that would come out of his house, killed his daughter. Or Lahavdil, he brings the Greek story of Agamemnon, that sacrifices his daughter Iphigenia, that they had to go, the Greek army had to go battle Troy, the Trojan War, and the gods needed to be appeased by him killing his daughter, sacrificing his daughter, he killed his daughter. These were all tragic heroes, that in order to do something, a greater good, they're willing to sacrifice their child. Says Kierkegaard, Abraham sacrificing Isaac had absolutely no meaning. With the death of the child, the cause dies also. There's no meaning to it. Meaningless. No intellect. No meaning. And that's what makes him the knight of faith. By the way, this idea, the Lubavitcher Rebbe says the same idea, mamash. This idea, the Rebbe has a whole sicha about exactly this idea. The famous sicha that the Rebbe speaks about, the Medrash. It's in the Kutei Sichas Chelek Chafei, the 25th volume of the Kutei Sichas. The Medrash says, when God spoke to Avram and said, kill Yitzchak, he says, Kach no es binches yichitcha. Please take your only son. So the Medrash says, why is God asking nicely? Please, kach no. Pretty pleased with a cherry on top. Since when did God get, you know, polite? Since when did he learn manners all of a sudden? It's a whole 613 commandments. He never says please or thank you. All of a sudden, kach no, please take Yitzchak. So the Medrash says, shelo yoimru lo shelo haya mamish barishoinim. The Medrash says, you know why God is saying he's begging Abraham? Because God is saying to Avram, if you don't pass this 10th and final test, everyone will say that the first 9 tests that I tested you were meaningless. That you left your father's house to go to an unknown land, that you were then tested with a famine and had to go down to Egypt, that your wife was taken from you, on all the tests that you were thrown into the burning furnace, you're willing to be burned alive? Meaningless. If you don't pass the 10th test, the Akedah. Ask the Rebbe, what does one have to do with the other? Why would anyone say that the first 9 were meaningless? Let's say Avram would not pass the Akedah. He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't be willing to do it. So what would people say? That Avram was Chashav Yid. He was a very holy Jew. He passed 9 tests. He wasn't willing to kill his son. That would mean they would be meaningless. So the Rebbe says, you know why the Akedah is the most meaningful test and all the other ones are meaningless compared to it? Because there's absolutely no reason to it. Because throughout history, there have been many, many Gentiles and many people that have been willing to die for their ideology. They're willing to kill for their ideology, their own children, thousands of other people. Death to the idealist is not that terrible of an option. And so the Rebbe says, this was the first test that was not about any cause. It was not had no meaning. Simply because God said so. Because God said so. This was when Abraham became the one that's doing, because God said so. And therefore we understand that what Kierkegaard says, the necessity, listen carefully, because now we're going to sum it up. The necessity to transcend intellect. The necessity to be able to, what's called Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shamayim, do what God says. That for sure we understand, Judaism says. Judaism agrees with. 100%. 100%. We all agree with Kierkegaard, the Rebbe Sicha, that a human being has to be willing to go beyond intellect. God said so. That's for sure 100% true. That's point one. We agree. We also agree, that's also simple, point 2, that there's such a thing as mishpatim, doing mitzvahs, logical mitzvahs, because God said so. Judaism says to use your intellect. All of Judaism is about intellect. That's 100% also true. Because God said so. You have to use your intellect. God wants you to use your intellect. That, of course, is true. But you understand that that's also a continuation of the first thing, of doing what God says. The question that we need to ask is, can we also agree with Kant? That's the question. Can we agree with Kant that human intellect has an intrinsic, inherent value divorced of a divine commandment? Can, according to Judaism, we lend credence to human intellect, to humanity, as self-standing? In other words, could man on his own terms also be moral? Of course we'd say we have to be moral because God said so. That's not the issue. That we know. That's the second point. The question that we need to ask is, according to Torah, is there a place for what Kant is saying? Is there a way of saying that a human being needs to use his intellect just because his intellect says so, without any transcendent inspiration? Like Kant says, if I'm not moral because it's coming from within, then I'm not moral. Then there's something else making me act a certain way. Is there a place in Judaism for humanity on its own terms? That my intellect, that I shouldn't kill just because my intellect says so. Just because my intellect says not to steal. That's the question. And my Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberger from Woodmere, said over a couple of times an interesting anecdote with Soloveitchik, Zochein Levracha. Rav Soloveitchik was saying once a shir, saying a deep shir in the Talmud and Gemara, and he said a whole very novel approach. It's a very big chiddush. So someone in the room asked Rav Soloveitchik, said, Rebbe, what's your source for such a thing? Such a novel idea. What's your source? So Soloveitchik, without batting an eyelash, said, a clear and rational mind. That's a good source. A clear and rational mind. The question we need to discuss tonight, and of course you understand we're going to get to what that means to us in daily life, what it means to us next time we eat a tuna fish sandwich, we'll get to that too. But the question that we now, the philosophical question that we need to ask now, is there, according to Torah, according to Judaism, a place for self-standing morality, completely autonomous morality, that I act according to my intellect just because my intellect is saying so? Not from a commandment from God, because my intellect dictates it. So you all understand we're going to begin with the ultimate answer. Anyone that learned in yeshiva, it's also girls today, Baruch Hashem. When you're asked a question in a class, what's the answer that you could always give and know that you're right? It's a machlekes. It's an argument. So in the Rishonim, we find this, what seems to be these two ways of looking at, whether we could say like Kant or not. We begin with, of course, the famous Bar Tanura. One cannot speak of ethics in Judaism without mentioning this Bar Tanura. Bar Tanura, some people today think Bar Tanura is just the name of a wine. I already saw that you're ready. Oh, I like that wine. Yeah. You know, all due respect, I also like that wine. It's really good. You know, with the M, no? Moscato. I also like, but Bar Tanura did not begin with a wine. It didn't begin as a wine. It's a sad fate. It's a good old Reb Avadia that he's become now known as, But Bar Tanura, before it was a wine, was a very holy Jew, an Italian Rishon, Reb Avadia Bar Tanura. And his commentary on the Mishnah is the standard commentary on the Mishnah. Anyone that's ever learned Mishnah has learned the Bar Tanura. And the Bar Tanura's remark in the very beginning of Pirkei Avot, the very first Mishnah of Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avot, Ethics from Sinai. What could be more of a book in Judaism about ethics like Pirkei Avot? Ethics from Sinai. How does Pirkei Avot begin? No, what do the words begin? Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. The oral tradition. The history of the oral tradition. Asks the Bar Tanura, what does it have to do with Pirkei Avot? Where should that be written? In Brachos. In the very beginning of Shas. Before we get to how to read Shema at night, right away start with the oral tradition. What does it have to do with Pirkei Avot, with the ethics? Says the Bar Tanura, exactly this idea, to show you that Jewish ethics is not like Gentile ethics, lahavdil. Jewish ethics is Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. It's a continuation of the Sinaitic revelation. God at Sinai told you not to put on a light on Shabbos, and He told you to put on your right shoe before your left shoe, and He also told you not to murder. Ethics, because God said so. Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. Case closed. That's it. Of course, who do you think is the quintessential example of the opposite, of the ultimate rationalist, that the human mind? The Rambam. Of course, the Rambam. The Rambam writes in the Shmoneh Prokim, in the Rambam's treatise on psychology, known as the 8 chapters, the Shmoneh Prokim. He says like this, Chazal say in the Gemara, now you have to listen carefully, Chazal say in the Gemara, in the Talmud the rabbis teach, Al toimer I ifshi lecho basar chazir, ele ifshi uma ese sh'ovi shebashamayim gozer alai. Do not say, the rabbis say, do not say, I don't want to eat pig. Pig is disgusting. You remember sour grapes? You remember Aesop's fables? Yeah? Remember sour grapes? Remember that? The fox that he's the really luscious looking grapes, and he's trying to get to the grapes, and he's jumping, and he can't get to the grapes. So what does the fox say? Ah, they're probably a sour anyway. Alright? So Chazal say, do not say, a disco? Boring. Ah, who wants to go? Blockbuster? That's ridiculous. Ah, not interesting. Do not say, pig, I don't want it. No, Chazal say, say, I want it, but what should I do that my Father in heaven does not let it? Say, if she, I want to eat pig, I want to sin, but what should I do that God said that I shouldn't do it? Comes Maimonides and says, what about when it comes to murdering? Stealing. The rabbis don't differentiate. The rabbis say, when it comes to sins, you should say, I want to do it. What should I do? God says I can't. So Maimonides says, does that apply also to rational, to the mishpatim? Should a person say, I'd really like to murder you. I would like to slice you up into little bits. I really would like to steal all your money. I'd like to burn you alive. But what should I do? You know that God, He doesn't let... So the Rambam writes that will make a person into a monster. If a person would say such a thing, I wish I could kidnap a few kids. Shucks, can't do it. Can't be a serial killer. So the Rambam says, Chas v'shal, the Rambam says, God forbid. The Rambam writes that the rabbis say, I should say, I want it, but what should I do? I'm not going to do it because God says so. That applies to chukim. That applies to laws that don't have a reason. But says Maimonides, when there are rational, ethical laws, not because God said so, and the way the Rambam says, and I'm quoting, listen to the words of the Rambam. In yonim ha-mefursomim etzel kol b'nei adam sheim ro'is. In yonim sheim mefursomim etzel ro'i b'nei adam. Things that most people, he's not talking about Jews. Maimonides is not just talking about Jews. Things that most people, that humanity detest, that Chazal are not speaking about. That you should say, I don't want to do them, because humanity says not to do them. Now you understand that Rambam seems to be saying, like Kant, he seems to be saying that morality, when it comes to things that are forbidden because of morality, you shouldn't want to do them. But that would mean, if we go according to the Rambam, in this way of looking at the Rambam, that means, yes, intellect is self-sufficient completely. And by the way, I need to say something, this is not directly, I mean it's related, but it's a parenthetical note, but it's a very interesting idea. You know that one of the greatest debates about the Rambam, about Maimonides, for the past 200, 300 years, has been an issue of a vav or an aleph. I don't know if you know about this, but it's very interesting. It's one of the most fascinating things in Jewish literature, that there's been huge debates about in the Rambam in one place. You know, you all know how a vav and an aleph look like, especially if you write it in script, and it changes a whole philosophy. The most famous attack on Maimonides was actually from Spinoza, Yimach Shmoy, Benedict Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza, that Spinoza completely decimated the Rambam. The Rambam writes in Hilchas Malachim at the end of chapter 9 of the Laws of Kings. The Rambam is speaking about the seven Noahide laws, the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, which we know are the foundation of what's today known as Judeo-Christian society, the foundation of humanity today, ultimate ethics and morality for all mankind. And the Rambam writes that in order for a Gentile of a portion of the world to come, he needs to keep these seven laws because God told Moses on Sinai. And says, which is ultimate revelation morality. And then the Rambam says, listen to this, but if you'll have a Gentile that will, and by the way, I need to say parenthetically, today most commentators hold that Christians and Muslims do that because they believe in the revelation at Sinai. It's important to point out. The Rambam goes on to say, but if there'll be a Gentile that will keep these seven laws, will act ethically and morally, not because God said so at Sinai, but because his mind directed him to do them, says the Rambam, Einoi mechaside umas ha'olam, he's not considered a righteous Gentile. And then he says either Elo mechachameihem or Veloi mechachameihem. That's a huge difference. According to the printed version that we have, the Rambam says, if a Gentile will be ethical not because God says so, he's not a righteous Gentile, Veloi mechachameihem, and he's not even wise. It's not considered wisdom at all. That's what the printed version that we have says. A goy that's ethical, a Gentile is ethical because his mind directed him. He's not a righteous Gentile. Viloy mechachameim, and he's not even considered wise. If it's not coming from God, it's worthless. Spinoza wrote against the Rambam and destroyed him, that the Rambam is saying that the mind is useless. And it's everyone is all angry at Spinoza, all the Jewish philosophers after him. He must be retarded. It's obvious that he was trying to be venomous against Judaism. Who could possibly call the Rambam the anti-rationalist? The Rambam is anti-rational. The Rambam is the one that's saying that a Gentile's mind that dictates him is worthless. Everyone understands that the girsa is Ela mechachameihem. He's not one of the righteous Gentiles, but he's a wise Gentile. That reason that human intellect is self-standing. That's seemingly what the Rambam says. But now I want to go, so we could say that's the way the Rambam says, the Bartanur says, intellect is self-standing or because God says so. The two sides of the coin. But then, of course, we come to that part of Torah, essence of Torah, that synthesizes everything. Because since God is an ultimate unity, so then all of Torah needs to be an ultimate unity. And that, of course, is Chassidus. Chassidus comes, and I need to point this out again. I said before I'm going to say it again, and I'll say it again. Most places in Chassidus says, most of the time what it says, most places in Chassidus say, most of the time what it says is, I need to use my intellect because God said so. The Kabbalah soul has to be chayder, has to penetrate my intellect. You have to use intellect, also part of the bittul, the nullification to God has to come to intellect. That's what it says most of the time. And of course, like I said, we agree with Kierkegaard. But I found one place where the Rebbe says, such a profound idea, I don't know if anyone has pointed this out in the academic circles or not yet, but it's, in my opinion, a revolutionary idea how to solve this plunter, this problem, in a way that's never been done before. And only Chassidus could do it. It's a sicha that the Rebbe said in Mishpatim Tovshin Nun Beis, 20 years ago, Parshas Mishpatim. Now Mishpatim Nun Beis, those who are familiar with the Rebbe's sichas, is very famous for having very, very overt messianic ideas to it, about Mashiach coming, and I don't have time to get into why that's related to it. Ein Shom, take a look over there. But within that sicha, there's a profound philosophical idea. But before we get to how the Rebbe solves this issue, I need to preface. Probably the most fundamental idea in all the Rebbe's teaching, this is a theme, that the Rebbe says all the time, over and over again. And that is, and in Chassidus generally, but especially our Rebbe's writings, that is, that a true revelation of God's unity means that the world as is, the darkness as is one with God. Which means, if you need to bring any external inspiration or illumination from an outside source in order to reveal God in something, that's not, you haven't yet reached the ultimate unity of God. In the lexicon of Chassidus, it's known as the Tachten Mitzad Atzmoy. God wants to unify himself with the lowest world, Dir B'Tachtonim, and wants a dwelling place in the lowest world. The Rebbe explains that the world as is, in its own terms, is unified with God, without any external illumination. And that's throughout, when the Rebbe says, that's what Mashiach is, the whole idea of Geula. Right? You all know the famous Geula, redemption, is that the exile as is one with God. Not that the world has to stop, nothing in the world has to change. The world as is will be shown to be one with God. I'll give you an example before we get back to ethics to make it more clear. Just to give you an example of how the Rebbe uses this idea, it'll make it more clear when we get back to ethics. Take the example of bitochen, trusting in God. Bitochen, trust in God. As the Rebbe said many times, trusting in God is even deeper than having faith in God. The Rebbe spoke about this a lot of times, that in the American dollar, right, the ultimate seeming sign of autonomy in today's world, the Rebbe said, doesn't just say in God we have faith, but in God we trust. Trust is a step deeper than faith. It doesn't just mean that you believe God exists, but it means that what? You put yourself in His hands. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the Rayatz, writes, what is the ultimate bitochen? What is the ultimate trust that a person could have in God? He writes in a letter, when a person is in a state where you see absolutely no way that one could naturally, within nature, have salvation, and yet you trust that God will help you, remember we spoke about last week, that's trust in God. To the extent that the previous Rebbe says, he gives an example. If you're in the middle of a stormy ocean, and you're about to drown, and you're hanging on by a hair to some boat, or you know, some hair is coming from heaven, you're hanging on by a hair that's about to snap, that's not yet, and you trust that you're going to be saved, that's not having trust in God. Because there's still an achiza in teva. There's still some natural way that your salvation will come. The ultimate trust in God is when there's absolutely no natural way you could be saved, and yet you trust in God. That's the ultimate trust, that's the ultimate bitochen. Comes the Rebbe, our Rebbe, and he says, it's rare that he overtly argues with his father-in-law, but over here he does. He says there's a higher level of bitachon. There's a higher level in trusting in God. And that is when you have a huge bank account with millions of dollars, and you have everything that you need, and you're not lacking anything in life, and yet you trust that everything you have comes from God every single moment. That's the ultimate trust in God. Not the negation of reality, not the negation of the world. With the world, realize that it's all from God. That's the ultimate messianic revelation, that the world as is one with Hashem. Doesn't have to have an outside illumination. So listen to the Rebbe's genius. Listen to this. And here you have to really concentrate. I hope I'll explain it properly. I'll try. And you have to try to concentrate. Listen to what the Rebbe says. He brings back that Rambam. That Maimonides that we said, the Rambam writes, and I quoted, those things that Roiv Bnei Adam, Gentiles, Goyim, intellect, those things that human intellect says is wrong, you have to say, I don't want to do them. Right? That's what we learned from the Rambam. Whatever human reason says is bad, that you should say, e if she, I don't want to do them. Says the Rebbe, since when does human intellect become a manda omar, an opinion, in the way a Jew is supposed to act? It means whatever civilization, whatever people say is a bad thing to do, you, a Jew, you should say, I don't want to do it. Not because Torah says so, but you should say you don't want to do it. So the Rebbe says, a Jew's hanhaga seemingly should be based on Torah. And as the Rebbe doesn't want to agree that the Rambam is saying like Kant, just like Kant. He doesn't want to allow that Rambam mamish means what Kant is saying, that humanity completely divorced of God. He wants to say, like Kant, that that humanity and intellect could be self-standing. But the Rebbe says a deeper thing. Listen carefully. The Rebbe says that we know that the Chazal teach us that the Torah is the blueprint of the universe. And Chassidus explains that, what does that mean? That the world emanated from God and His Torah. The world is a physical emanation, a physical manifestation of God and His Torah. Therefore, that means that in God's chokhmah, in God's wisdom, there's something called mishpatim, which means that within Torah, there are those things in Torah that God in His wisdom, in Torah's outlook, Torah calls them mishpatim, logical. That caused that the human mind emanated to become in such a way that the human mind on its own, self-standing, on its own terms, looks at those things as being ethical. You understand? In other words, human reason is self-standing. It's not an outside illumination. You don't need to have a commandment from God. No, the Rambam is saying what your mind dictates. If your mind says it's wrong, you should do it because your mind is saying it. Because your mind says it's wrong, that's why you shouldn't do it. But the Rebbe says, but you know why? Because you know what the human mind is? It's God. The human mind is the physical manifestation of the mind of God. That in Torah, there's a section of Torah known as Mishpatim. Torah, which is one with God's light, has those laws that are called Mishpatim, ethical, intellect, that caused that when humanity's mind emanated from that, it emanated in such a way that a Gentile's clear and rational mind will say like what the Mishpatim say. And therefore the Rebbe says, yes, there is a place for humanity, for intellect, without any commandment. Vaharaya, Maimonides says so. Maimonides is saying, what humanity says is wrong, do it because it's wrong, because it's ethical. But the Rebbe says, but that's not divorced from God. Not that it's a commandment from God. It's autonomous morality. The Rambam is saying, you have to be moral because your mind says so. But you know why your mind says so, the Rebbe says? Because your mind is a physical manifestation of God's mind. It's not that you need to be commanded. No, you do these things because you keep them because they're ethical. But the result, the reason that your mind says they're ethical is because that's how it is in God's mind. That's what the Rebbe says. In other words, humanity, ethics have essential intrinsic value. They do. But you know why? Because they're an emanation of God's mind. You don't need an outside source. You don't need an outside inspiration. It's humanity on its own terms. Humanity on its own terms is one with God. The world as is the light of God. And that's why the Rambam is saying you go according to what morality says. And now it's already late and I apologize, but I need a couple of minutes. Another couple of minutes. If you need to go, you know, I'm not insulted. But now let's go a step deeper. And let's go to another parallel. And I think this is a beautiful idea. Now that we understood the three ways of how to relate to intellect, intellect on its own, throwing intellect out the window, or feeling intellect as is one with God, we could parallel that to also three ways of looking at life and looking at the world around you and the people that you deal with. Mamish parallel. Kant writes that you must treat humanity not as a means to an end, but as an end to itself. According to Kant, humanity is the end. It's not a means to an end. Humanity is the only thing that interests me. He writes that whatever besides good life conduct man fancies he can do to be well-pleasing to God is mere religious illusion and pseudo-service of God. Anything that my mind can't understand, anything that's not humanity, doesn't interest God. Just the world. Whatever the world, my relationship to the world, that's all there is. Because humanity, because intellect is self-standing. Kierkegaard, on the other hand, it's well known that according to most Mefarshim, according to most commentators on Kierkegaard, Kierkegaard wrote his book Fear and Trembling after a very interesting anecdote when he broke up his engagement. He was engaged to a woman known as Regine Olsen. There have been those philosophers that have said that she's been one of the most meaningful people in the history of philosophy because she inspired, you know, Kierkegaard's philosophy. He wrote this book, Fear and Trembling. He was engaged to this young woman and he reneged on his vow. He made an ethical vow. He was engaged to her and he reneged. He didn't marry her. And according to most commentators, he wrote this book, Fear and Trembling, explaining the idea that just like the night of faith and fear and trembling, the religious duty means that one has to go above moral responsibility to become a knight of faith, so too, the knight of faith has to be able to go above any personal happiness, any vow of marriage, and only then, Kierkegaard was explaining himself, could he become the ultimate Christian writer? Could he become the ultimate knight of faith? Women are the temptation to finitude. Women are those that for force a person to remain within the realm of the finite, to remain within the realm of physicality. And therefore Kierkegaard was writing that to be able to become in a state of one-to-one with God, he needs to transcend everything ethical and universal and renege on his engagement to Regine Olsen. Now, I must tell you that if you read Tanya, you read Tanya improperly, it sounds like that also. In chapter 49 of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe writes, I don't have time to get into it, but if you look over there in chapter 49, the Alter Rebbe says that by the Shema, you have to arouse such a love of God that what? Mafkir isha ubanov. You have to be willing to give up your wife and your children. A love of God that, so to speak, goes beyond your family, goes beyond your wife, goes beyond your children. That seems to be like Kierkegaard is saying, throw humanity out the window, throw the world out the window, throw Regine Olsen out the window. So you're enjoying this, yeah? But then we have the beautiful teaching of the Maharal and the Sfas Emes, which is, Sfas Emes really explains the Maharal. Again, I don't have time to elaborate, but you all remember Yaakov Avinu when he met Yosef. When Jacob met Joseph after 22 years of not seeing his son, what did the rabbis say? What did he do? When Joseph was crying, what did Yaakov begin doing? Saying the Shema, meditating on God's unity. Meditating on God's unity. And the Sfas Emes explains, based on the Maharal, and this is what the Alter Rebbe means also, that means, what does it mean that he was meditating on God's unity? Other people, the Regine Olsens of the world, are not hindrances on the path to God, they are the path to God. The ultimate unity of God is that the love that you have to your family, to your children, etc., is the way to get to God. People are the way to God. They're not a roadblock on the way to God. A woman, a wife, might be a temptation to finitude if done improperly, but the way that another philosopher writes, according to Chassidus, she could also be fulfilled finitude. Fulfilled finitude means when you look at those things in life that are beautiful, that are terrific, that you love, and you see God in them. That's the ultimate. And that's this third level that we're saying what the Rebbe says. The world as is the light of God. That's Chassidus. That's this idea that we're learning. Humanity, intellect, the world that you experience could be like Kierkegaard sort. And you all understand that Kierkegaard is coming from a Christian background, and I don't need to explain to you that this is all a direct result of Christian teaching. Okay, so according to Kierkegaard, yes, women and physicality, you need to throw them out the window to reach God. Comes Chassidus, which is the ultimate synthesis, the synthesis of Torah that says the true unity of God means that those people that you love are the way to God. And now we come to the clincher. And I apologize for going over time. A few more minutes. Again, if you need to leave, it's okay. But mama's another few minutes, blee nether. Here we come to the clincher. Kierkegaard makes a very big deal, a whole chapter of his book, about the silence of Abraham. Abraham's silence. That he did not disclose, not to Sarah, not to Eliezer, and not to Isaac, he didn't tell what he was about to do. And that goes, that's incongruous with the rest of Kierkegaard's Shita. By the way, he used a pseudonym. When he wrote Fear and Trembling, he took a pen name. Remember, the pen name was Johannes de Silentio, John the Silent. That's the name that he wrote the book with, Johannes de Silentio, the Silent John. He makes a whole big deal out of silence, and of course that goes with his whole idea that a person that is a true knight of faith is in a state of being an affront to humanity. You have to be a complete affront to humanity. There's no way to explain yourself to another human being. You have to put yourself in it. You have to exile to yourself from the whole realm of human discourse. It's just you and God. Isolation. There's no way to explain to people what you're doing. And that's what he says. That's why Agamemnon, when he kills his daughter Iphigenia, has a whole speech to the Greek army. He's able to justify, glorify what he's doing. He has a whole speech. Abraham is silent. Silent. He doesn't tell anyone because nobody could be part of that solitary one with him and God. Now, most Jewish philosophers that discuss Kierkegaard write the very blatant fact that what do we know? What does the Medrash say about Abraham and Isaac? No? That he told Isaac, right? Rashi brings it. The Medrash says that Avram did tell Isaac that he's about to kill him. He did invite him in, he did make him privy to that information. And so the Jewish philosophers that are anti-Kierkegaard point out that that means this idea that in Judaism, faith is a community. It's a communal covenant. We in Judaism do not believe in the solitary one. We believe in a covenant in a tzibur. That's what most Jewish philosophers write. But Chassidus can't say that. Chassidus very much stresses the concept of the individual. And I must say, by the way, there are the Poshupshat, if you read the Chumash, the verses, it does seem like Abraham is not telling Yitzhak what he's about to do. And by the way, the Ibn Ezra argues with Chazal, like only the Ibn Ezra knew how. The Ibn Ezra argues with Chazal and say that Avram did not tell Yitzhak what he's about to do. He did remain silent. This idea of the necessity of being silent is found in Jewish sources. The most blatant one, of course, is from Reb Nachman of Breslov. In Sichos Haran, the very first piece in Sichos Haran, Reb Nachman writes, "Ki atu yadati ki gadol Hashem mikol elokim." Now I know that God is the greatest. Says Reb Nachman, what do I mean by now? Reb Nachman says that my perception of God that I have now, I will never have again. I didn't have yesterday and I probably will not have tomorrow. Reb Nachman says that a person has to every moment be coming into a state of individual relationship with God that cannot be conveyed not only to anybody else, but even to yourself a different day. It's such an absolute relationship that atu yadati, now I know, I won't know tomorrow. And this idea of the mystical silence, of course, you all know that Rav Soloveitchik has a whole book about it called The Lonely Man of Faith. This whole idea of the necessity of being in a silent covenant and a solitude with God. The inability to sustain a feeling, to sustain that feeling of and relate it to other people, that we can't say that there is no such place for that in Judaism. By the way, there was a chassid called Reb Zalman Moshe, who was known as being a big oivid, or a server of God. And there was another chassid called Reb Moshe Gurari, happens to be my father-in-law's uncle. He was a very big genius in Hasidic teachings. So Reb Zalman Moshe once went over to Moshe Gurari. I heard this from Reb Yol Kahn, Shpin Kranites. Reb Zalman Moshe went to Moshe Gurari and said, "Tell me, what's Atzmus? Define for me the essence of God." So Moshe Gurari opened his mouth, and as soon as he opened his mouth, Zalman Moshe gave him a slap across the face. As soon as he opened his mouth, he said, "That's not Atzmus. If you're opening your mouth, it's really not the essence of God." So we can't deny that Chassidus has this idea that there's this solitude with God. That's true. That's what davening is all about. Being in a state of one-to-one, just you and God. And that's why I must say that many Chassidus does not argue with the fact that sometimes a person needs to daven alone. A person needs to daven just him and God, not to daven with a minion, not to daven with 10 people, just you and God. But now we come to the clincher. Listen carefully. There's a phrase by Chassidim. I heard this from Avraham Shem Tov Zangezin. The pisk is for schweigen und the eugen seiden for reden, which means the mouth, God gave us a mouth in order to be silent. He gave us eyes in order to talk. He gave us a mouth in order to be silent. He gave us eyes in order to talk. And Rabbi Avraham Shem Tov said that he once was by a Ferbrengen of Tuch Sidim, Reperetz Motchkin, and I don't remember the other one, that they sat the whole night, the two friends, with a bottle of mashke. They said l'chaim, and they looked each other in the eye and sang a niggin. Again said l'chaim, looked each other in the eye and sang a niggin, sang a song, and this was the whole night. They didn't say a word. They didn't say a word. The crazy thing, the revolutionary thing about Hasidus, the brotherhood of the Hasidic movement, is that same movement that's so into individuality, so into entering a one-on-one with God, is into a brotherhood, is into a community. Ferbrengen. How does that go together? And the answer is, here we come to the ultimate difference of Hasidus. That aspect of a person coming to that deepest level of connection with God, at that place that puts you to the state of being a solitary one, when it's you and God, comes the Alter Rebbe in chapter 32 of Tanya and says, that's where we're all one. The Alter Rebbe in chapter 32 of Tanya says, you know where Jewish unity comes from? Not intellect. Not intellect. The Alter Rebbe says Jewish unity, Achdus Avos Yisrael, comes when you reach that state that transcends humanity. Like Kierkegaard says, you come to that state of the solitary one, it's you and God. Just you and God. And you look around and all the Jewish people are there with you. All the souls of the Jewish people are all one. At that place of God, when it's just God and you've transcended humanity, that's where you're one with the entire Jewish people. That's where there's the ultimate achdus. That's what the Alter Rebbe is saying. Unity, brotherhood, that comes from transcending intellect. It comes from going beyond intellect. It's not throwing Regina Olsen out the window. At that place is where you see those people, the Jewish people, with you. When you stand one-to-one with God, that's when you come to the ultimate achdus and the love of the Jewish people. And that's Mashiach. Mashiach is this ultimate unity of God, the ultimate synthesis of reality. Looking at a tuna fish sandwich, looking at that Jew, looking at yourself and looking at your mind as